But have you ever been with a prostitute?
I said that I had not.
It's as if they were looking over merchandise. It doesn't take long to get used to being looked at like that. They're paying money for flesh, after all. It makes sense for them to examine the goods. But the way that man looked at me was different. He seemed to be looking through my flesh, to something on the other side. His eyes made me feel uneasy, as if I had become a half-transparent human being. I was a little confused, I suppose. I dropped my handbag on the floor. It made a small sound, but I was in such an abstracted state that for a time I was almost unaware of what I had done. Then I stooped down to pick up the bag. The clasp had opened when it hit the floor, and some of my cosmetics had fallen out. I picked up my eyebrow pencil and lip cream and a small bottle of eau de cologne, returning each of them to my bag. He kept those eyes of his trained on me the whole time. When I had finished gathering up my things from the floor and putting them back in the bag, he told me to undress. I asked him if it would be all right for me to take a shower first, because I had been perspiring quite a bit. The weather was hot that day, and I had been sweating on the subway. He didn't care about that, he said. He didn't have much time. He wanted me to undress right away. Once I was naked, he told me to lie face down on the bed, which I did. He ordered me to stay still, to keep my eyes closed, and not to speak until I was spoken to. He sat down next to me with his clothes on. That was all he did. Sit down. He did not lay a finger on me. He just sat and looked at my naked body. He kept this up for some 10 minutes, while I lay there, unmoving, face down. I could feel his eyes boring into the nape of my neck, my back, my buttocks, and my legs, with almost painful intensity. It occurred to me that he might be impotent. Customers like that turn up now and then. They pay for a prostitute, have her undress, and they look at her. Some will undress the woman and finish themselves off in her presence. All kinds of men go to prostitutes, for all kinds of reasons. I just assumed he was one of those. After a while, though, he reached out and began to touch me. His 10 fingers moved down my body, from my shoulders to my back, from my back to my buttocks, in search of something. This was not foreplay. Neither, of course, was it a massage. His fingers moved over my body with the utmost care, as if tracing a route on a map. And all the while, he touched my flesh. He seemed to be thinking, not in any ordinary sense of the word, but seriously thinking about something with the utmost concentration. 1 minute his fingers would seem to be wandering here and there at random, and the next they would come to a stop and remain for a long time in one place. It felt as if the fingers themselves were going from confusion to certainty. Am I making myself clear? Each finger seemed to be alive and thinking, with a will of its own. It was a very strange sensation, strange and disturbing. And yet, the touch of his fingers aroused me sexually, for the first time in my life. Sex had been nothing but a source of pain for me until I became a prostitute. The mere thought of it had filled me with fear of the pain I knew I would have to endure. Just the opposite happened after I became a prostitute. I felt nothing. I no longer felt pain, but I felt no other sensations either. I would sigh and pretend to be aroused for the pleasure of the customer. But it was all fake, a professional act. When he touched me, though, my sighs were real. They came out of my body's innermost depths. I knew that something inside me had begun to move, as if my center of gravity were changing location in my body, first to one place and then to another. At last, the man stopped moving his fingers. With his hands on my waist, he seemed to be thinking. Through his fingertips, I could tell that he was steadying himself, quietly regularizing his breathing. Then he began to remove his clothing. I kept my eyes closed and my face buried in the pillow, waiting for what would come next. Once he was naked, he spread my arms and legs open wide. The room was almost frighteningly quiet. The only sound was the soft rush of the air conditioner. The man himself made almost no perceptible sounds. I couldn't even hear him breathing. He placed his palms on my back. I went limp. His penis touched my buttocks, but it was still soft. Just then the phone on the night table began to ring. I opened my eyes and turned my head to look at the man's face, but he seemed unaware that the phone was ringing. It rang 8 or 9 times and then stopped. Again, the room became silent.
Krita Kano paused at that point for a few measured breaths. She remained silent, looking at her own hands.
"I'm sorry,"
she said,
"but do you mind if I take a short break?"
"Not at all," I said. I refilled my coffee cup and took a sip. She drank her cold water. We sat there without speaking for a good 10 minutes.
His fingers began to move again, touching every part of my body,
Krita Kano continued.
Every part without exception. I lost the power to think. My ears were filled with the sound of my own heart, pounding but with a strange slowness. I could no longer control myself. I cried out, aloud, again and again as he caressed me. I tried to keep my voice in check, but another someone was using my voice to moan and shout. I felt as if every screw in my body had come loose. Then, after a very long time, and with me still lying face down, he put something inside me from behind. What it was, I still have no idea. It was huge and hard. But it was not his penis. I am certain of that. I remember thinking that I had been right. He was impotent after all. Whatever it was that he put inside me, it made me feel pain for the first time since my failed suicide attempt. Real, intense pain that belonged to me and to no one else. How can I put this? The pain was almost impossibly intense, as if my physical self were splitting in two from the inside out. And yet, as terrible as it felt, I was writhing as much in pleasure as in pain. The pleasure and pain were one. Do you see what I mean? The pain was founded on pleasure and the pleasure on pain. I had to swallow the two as a single entity. In the midst of this pain and pleasure, my flesh went on splitting in two. There was no way for me to prevent it from happening. Then something very weird occurred. From between the two split halves of my physical self came crawling a thing that I had never seen or touched before. How large it was, I could not tell, but it was as wet and slippery as a newborn baby. I hadn't the slightest idea what it was. It had always been inside me, and yet it was something of which I had no knowledge. This man had drawn it out of me. I wanted to know what it was. I wanted to see it with my own eyes. It was a part of me, after all. I had a right to see it, but this was impossible. I was caught in the torrent of pleasure and pain, an entirely physical being. I could only cry out and drool and churn my hips. The mere act of opening my eyes was an impossibility. I then reached a sexual peak, although, rather than a peak, it felt more as if I were being thrown from a high cliff. I screamed, and I felt as if every piece of glass in the room had shattered. I not only felt it, I actually saw and heard the windows and drinking glasses shattering into powdered fragments and felt them raining down on me. I then felt sick to my stomach. My consciousness began to slip away, and my body turned cold. I know this will sound strange, but I felt as if I had turned into a bowl of cold porridge, all sticky and lumpy, and the lumps were throbbing slowly and hugely with each beat of my heart. I recognized this throbbing. It had happened to me before. Nor did it take very long for me to remember what it was. I knew it as that dull, fatal, never-ending pain that I had experienced before my failed suicide attempt. And like a crowbar, the pain was prying open the lid of my consciousness, prying it open with an irresistible force and dragging out the jellied contents of my memory without the consent of my will. Strange as it may sound, I was like a dead person watching her own autopsy. Do you see what I mean? I felt as if I were watching from some vantage point as my body was being cut open and one slimy organ after another was being pulled out of me. I continued to lie there, drooling on the pillow, my body racked with convulsions, incontinent. I knew that I should try to control myself, but I had lost the power for such control. Every screw in my body had not only come loose, but had fallen out. In my clouded brain, I felt with incredible intensity exactly how alone and how powerless I was. Everything came gushing out of me. Things both tangible and intangible turned to liquid and flowed out through my flesh like saliva or urine. I knew that I should not let this happen, that I should not allow my very self to spill out this way and be lost forever, but there was nothing I could do to staunch the flow. I could only watch it happen. How long this continued, I have no idea. It seemed as if all my memories, all my consciousness had just slipped away. Everything that had been inside me was outside now. At last, like a heavy curtain falling, darkness enveloped me in an instant, and when I regained consciousness, I was a different person.
Krita Kano stopped speaking at that point and looked at me.
That is what happened,
she said softly. I said nothing, but waited instead for the rest of her story. 14. Krita Kano's new departure. Krita Kano went on with her story.
For some days after that, I lived with the feeling that my body had fallen apart. Walking, I had no sense that my feet were touching the ground. Eating, I had no sense that I was chewing on anything. Sitting still, I had the terrifying feeling that my body was either endlessly falling or floating up beneath a big balloon through infinite space. I could no longer connect my body's movements or sensations with my own self. They were functioning as they wished, without reference to my will, without order or direction. And yet I knew no way to bring calm to this intense chaos. All I could do was wait for things to settle down in their own good time. I locked myself in my room from morning to night, hardly eating a thing, and telling my family that I was not feeling well. Some days went by like this, 3 or 4, I would say. And then all of a sudden, everything quietened down, as if a wild wind had blown through and gone on its way. I looked around, and I examined myself, and I realized that I had become a new person, quite different from what I had been until then. This was my third self. My first self had been the one that lived in the endless anguish of pain. My second self had been the one that lived in a state of pain-free numbness. The first one had been me in my original state, unable to shift the heavy yoke of pain from my neck. And when I did attempt to shift it, which is to say when I tried to kill myself and failed, I became my second self, an interim me. True, the physical pain that had tortured me until then had disappeared, but all other sensations had retreated with it into the haze. My will to live, my physical vitality, my mental powers of concentration, all these had disappeared along with the pain. After I passed through that strange period of transition, what emerged was a brand new me. Whether this was the me that should have been there all along, I could not yet tell. But I did have the sense, however vague and undefined it might be, that I was at least heading in the right direction.
Krita Kano raised her eyes and looked at me, as if she wanted to hear my impressions of her story. Her hand still rested on the table. So then, I said, what you're saying is that the man gave you a new self, am I right?
Perhaps he did,
said Krita Kano, nodding. Her face was as expressionless as the bottom of a dried-up pond.
being caressed by that man, and held by him, and made to feel such intense sexual pleasure for the first time in my life, I experienced some kind of gigantic physical change. Why it happened, and why of all people it had to be that man who made it happen, I have no idea. Whatever the process may have been, the fact remains that at the end of it, I found myself in a whole new container. And once I had passed through the deep confusion I mentioned earlier, I sought to accept this new self as something truer, if for no other reason than that I had been enabled to escape from my profound numbness, which had been such a suffocating prison to me. Still, the bad aftertaste remained with me for a long time, like a dark shadow. Each time I recalled those 10 fingers of his, each time I recalled that thing he put inside me, each time I recalled that slimy, lumpish thing that came, or felt as if it came, out of me, I felt terribly uneasy. I felt a sense of anger and despair that I had no means of dealing with. I tried to erase that day from my memory, but this I was unable to do because the man had pried open something inside my body. The sensation of having been pried open stayed with me, inseparably bonded to the memory of that man, along with an unmistakable sense of defilement. It was a contradictory feeling. Do you see what I mean? The transformation that I had experienced was undoubtedly something right and true, but the transformation had been caused by something filthy, something wrong and false. This contradiction, this split, would torment me for a very long time.
Again, Greta Cano stared at her hands as they lay on the table.
After that, I stopped selling my body. There was no longer any point to it.
Greta Cano's face remained expressionless. You could quit? Just like that? I asked. She nodded.
Just like that,
she said.
I didn't say anything to anybody. Just stopped selling myself. But this caused no problem. It was almost disappointing how easy it was. I'd thought they would at least call me, and I was bracing myself for the day, but it never came. They never said a thing to me. They knew my address. They knew my phone number. They could have threatened me. But nothing happened. And so, on the surface at least, I had become an ordinary girl again. By that time, I had repaid my parents everything I owed them, and I had put away a good deal of money. With what I gave him, my brother had bought another new car to waste his time driving around in, but he could never have imagined what I had done to pay him back. I needed time to get used to my new self. What kind of a being was this self of mine? How did it function? What did it feel? And how? I had to grasp each of these things through experience, to memorize and stockpile them. Do you see what I'm saying? Virtually everything inside me had spilled out and been lost. I was completely new, but I was also completely empty. I had to fill in that blank, little by little. With my own hands, I had to construct this thing I called I, or rather, make the things that constituted me. I was still officially a student, but I had no intention of returning to university. I would leave the house in the morning, go to a park, and sit by myself on a bench all day, doing nothing. Or I would wander up and down the paths in the park. When it rained, I would go to the library, put a book on the table in front of me, and pretend to be reading. I sometimes spent the whole day in a cinema or riding round and round the city on the Yamanote Circle Line. I felt as if I were floating in a pitch-black space all by myself. There was no one I could go to for advice. If my sister Malta had been there, I could have shared everything with her. But at that time, of course, she was in seclusion far away on the island of Malta, performing her austerities. I did not know her address. I had no way of contacting her, and so I had to solve these problems by myself. No book explained the kind of thing that I had experienced. Still, although I was lonely, I was not unhappy. I was able to cling to myself. At least now, I had a self to cling to. My new self was able to feel pain, though not with that earlier intensity. I could feel it, but at the same time, I had learned a method of escaping from it, which is to say I was able to disconnect from the physical self that was feeling the pain. Do you see what I'm saying? I was able to divide myself into a physical self and a non-physical self. It may sound difficult when I describe it like this, but once you learn the method, it is not difficult at all. When pain comes to me, I leave my physical self. It's just like quietly slipping into the next room when someone you don't want to meet comes along. It is very natural. I recognize that pain has come to my body. I feel the existence of the pain. But I am not there. I am in the next room. And so the yoke of the pain is not able to burden me.
And you can separate from yourself like that any time you please?
No,
said Krita Kano, after thinking it for a moment.
At first, I could do it only when my body was experiencing physical pain. Pain was the key to the splitting of my consciousness. Later, with Multicano's help, I learned to do it at will to some extent, but that was much later. Before long, a letter arrived from Multicano. She told me that she had finally finished 3 years of training on Malta and within a week would be returning to Japan. She planned to live in Japan permanently from then on. I was thrilled at the prospect of seeing her again. We had been apart for nearly 8 years. And as I mentioned earlier, Malta was the only person in the world to whom I could freely tell everything that was in my heart. On the day she came back to Japan, I told Malta everything that had happened to me. She listened to my long, strange story to the very end, without comment, without asking a single question. And when I was finished, she heaved a deep sigh and said to me, "I know I should have been with you. I should have been watching over you all this time. For some reason, I never realized that you had such profound problems. Perhaps it was because you were simply too close to me. But in any case, there were things I had to do. There were places I had to go, alone. I had no choice in the matter." I told her that she should not let it bother her. These were my problems after all, and I was improving little by little. She thought about this for a while, saying nothing, and then she said, "All the things you have been through ever since I left Japan have been painful and bitter for you, but as you say, you have been moving towards the proper state, step by step. The worst is over for you, and it will never come back. Such things will never happen to you again. It will not be easy, but you will be able to forget many things once a certain amount of time has passed. Without a true self, though, a person cannot go on living. It is like the ground we stand on. Without the ground, we can build nothing. There is one thing, however, which you must never forget, and that is that your body has been defiled by that man. It is a thing that should never have happened. You could have been lost forever. You might have had to wander forever through nothingness. Fortunately, the state of your being just happened not to be the real, original you, and so it had the reverse effect. Instead of trapping you, it liberated you from your transitory state. This happened through sheer good luck. The defilement, however, remains inside you, and at some point you will have to rid yourself of it. This is something that I cannot do for you. I cannot even tell you how to do it. You will have to discover the method for yourself and do it by yourself." My sister then gave me my new name, Krita Kano, newly reborn. I needed a new name, she said. I liked it from the start. Malta Kano then began to use me as a spiritual medium. Under her guidance, I learned more and more how to control my new self and how to divide the flesh from the spirit. Finally, for the first time in my life, I became capable of living with a sense of peace. Of course, my true self was still something that lay beyond my grasp. I was still lacking too much for that to happen. But now, in Malta Cano, I had a companion by my side, someone I could depend upon, someone who understood me and accepted me. She became my guide and my protector.
But then you met Noboru Wataya again, didn't you? Krita Kano nodded.
That is true,
she said.
I did meet Noboru Wataya again. It happened early in March of this year. More than 5 years had passed since I had been taken by him and undergone my transformation and begun to work with Malta Kano. We came face to face again when he visited our home to see Malta. We did not speak to each other. I merely caught a glimpse of him in the hallway. But one glimpse was all it took to freeze me in my tracks, as if I had been struck by lightning. It was that man, the last man to buy me. I called Malta Kano aside and told her that he was the man who had defiled me. Fine, she said. Just leave everything to me. Don't worry. You keep out of sight. Make sure he doesn't see you. I did as I was told, which is why I do not know what he and Malta Kano discussed.
What could Noboru Wataya have possibly wanted from Malta Kano? Krita Kano shook her head.
I am sorry, Mr. Okada. I have no idea.
People come to your house because they want something. Isn't that usually the case?
Yes, it is.
What kinds of things do they come for?
All kinds of things.
But what kinds of things? Can you give me an example? Krita Kano bit her lip for a moment.
Lost things, their destinies, the future, everything.
And you two know about those things?
We do. Not absolutely everything, but most of the answers are in here,
said Krita Kano, pointing at her temple.
You just have to go inside.
Like going down into a well?
Yes, like that.
I put my elbows on the table and took a long, deep breath. Now, if you don't mind, there's something I'd like you to tell me. You showed up in my dreams a few times. You did this consciously. You willed it to happen. Am I right?
Yes, you are right,
said Krita Kano.
It was an act of will. I entered your consciousness and joined my body with yours.
You can do things like that?
Yes, I can. That is one of my functions.
You and I joined our bodies together in my mind. When I heard myself speaking these words, I felt as if I had just hung a bold, surrealistic painting on a white wall, and then as if looking at the painting from a distance to make sure it was not hanging crooked, I said the words again. You and I joined our bodies together in my mind. But I never asked you two for anything. It never even crossed my mind to find out anything from you. Right? So why did you take it upon yourself to do such a thing?
Because I was ordered to by Malta Kano.
Meaning that Malta Kano used you as a medium to hunt around inside my mind? What was she looking for? Answers for Noboru Wataya or for Kumiko? Krita Kano said nothing for a time. She seemed confused.
I don't really know, she said. I was not given detailed information. That way I can function more spontaneously as a medium. My only job is to have people's minds pass through me. It is Malta Kano's job to assign meaning to what I find there. But please understand, Mr. Okada, Malta Kano is fundamentally on your side. I hate Noboru Wataya, you see, and Malta Kano's first concern is for me. She did this for your sake, Mr. Okada. That is what I believe.
Krita Kano went out to the local supermarket. I gave her money and suggested that as she was going out, she should change into more respectable clothing. She nodded and went to Kumiko's room, where she put on a white cotton blouse and a floral pattern skirt.
It doesn't bother you, Mr. Okada, for me to put on your wife's clothing?
I shook my head. Her letter told me to get rid of it all. No one's going to be bothered if you wear her things. Just as I expected, everything fitted her perfectly. Uncannily so. Even her shoe size was the same. Krita Kano left the house wearing a pair of Kumiko's sandals. The sight of Krita Kano in Kumiko's clothing made me feel once again that reality was changing its direction, the way a huge passenger ship lumbers into a new course. After Krita Kano had gone out, I lay on the sofa staring at the garden, my mind a blank. She came back by taxi 30 minutes later, holding 3 large bags stuffed with groceries. Then she made me ham and eggs and a sardine salad.
"Tell me, Mr. Okada, do you have any interest in Crete?"
Krita Kano asked without warning after we had eaten. "Crete?" I said. "You mean the island of Crete in the Mediterranean?"
"Yes."
I shook my head. "I don't know," I said. "I'm not uninterested, I suppose. I've never thought much about it."
"Would you like to go to Crete with me?"
"Go to Crete with you?" I echoed.
"I would like to get away from Japan for a while. That is what I was thinking about the whole time I was in the well after you left. Ever since Malta gave me the name Krita, I have felt that I would like to go to Crete some day. As preparation, I read many books about the island. I even studied Greek so that I would be able to live there when the time came. I have fairly substantial savings, enough for us to live on for a good length of time without difficulty. You would not have to worry about money."
"Does Malta Kano know you're planning to go to Crete?"
"No. I haven't said anything to her about it, but I am sure she would not be opposed to the idea. She would probably think it was a good thing for me. She's been using me as a medium for the past 5 years, but it is not as if she has merely been exploiting me as some kind of tool. She's been doing it to aid my recovery as well. She believes that by passing the minds or egos of a variety of people through me, she will make it possible for me to obtain a firm grasp of my own self. Do you see what I mean? It works for me as a kind of vicarious experience of what it feels like to have an ego. Come to think of it, I've never once in my life said unambiguously to anybody, 'I want to do this.' I've never even thought to myself, 'I want to do this.' From the moment of my birth, I lived with pain at the center of my life. My only purpose in life was to find a way to coexist with intense pain. And after I turned 20 and the pain disappeared when I attempted to kill myself, a deep numbness came to replace the pain. I was like a walking corpse. A thick veil of unfeeling was draped over me. I had nothing, not a sliver of what could be called my own will. And then, when my flesh was violated and my mind pried open by Noboru Wataya, I obtained my third self. Even so, I was still not myself. All I had managed to do was get a grasp on the minimum necessary container for a self, a mere container. And as a container, under the guidance of Malta Kano, I passed many egos through myself. This, then, is how I have spent the 26 years of my life. Just imagine, if you will, for 26 years, I was nothing. This is the thought that struck me with such force when I was alone in the well, thinking. During all this long time, the person called me was in fact nothing at all, I realized. I was nothing but a prostitute of the flesh, a prostitute of the mind. Now, however, I am trying to get a grasp on my new self. I am neither a container nor a medium. I am trying to establish myself here on the face of the earth."
"I understand what you're saying to me, but still, why do you want to go to Crete with me?"
"Because it could be a good thing for both of us, for you, Mr. Okada, and for me,"
said Krita Kano.
"For the time being, there is no need for either of us to be here. And if that is the case, I feel it would be better for us not to be here. Tell me, Mr. Okada, do you have some course of action you must follow? Some plan for what you are going to do from this point on?"
"The one thing I need to do is talk to Kumiko. Until we meet face to face and she tells me that our life together is finished, I can't do anything else. How I'm going to go about finding her, though, I have no idea."
"But if you do find her, and your marriage is, as you say, finished, would you consider coming to Crete with me? Both of us would have to start something new at some point,"
said Krita Kano, looking into my eyes.
"It seems to me that going to the island of Crete would not be a bad beginning.
Not bad at all, I said. Sudden, maybe, but not a bad beginning. Kritikana smiled at me. When I thought about it, I realized this was the first time she had ever done so. It made me feel that, to some extent, history was beginning to head in the right direction.
We still have time, she said. Even if I hurry, it will take me at least 2 weeks to get ready. Please use the time to think it over, Mr. Okada. I don't know if there is anything I can give you. It seems to me that I don't have anything to give right now. I'm quite literally empty. I'm just getting started, putting some contents into this empty container, little by little. I can give you myself, Mr. Okada, if you say that is good enough for you. I believe we can help each other.
I nodded. I'll think about it, I said. I'm very pleased that you made me this offer, and I think it would be great if we could go together. I really do. But I've got a lot of things I have to think about, and a lot of things I have to straighten out.
And if, in the end, you say you don't want to go to Crete, don't worry. I won't be hurt. I will be sorry. But I want your honest answer.
Kritikano stayed in my house again that night. As the sun was going down, she invited me out for a stroll in the local park. I decided to forget about my bruise and leave the house. What was the point of worrying about such things? We walked for an hour in the pleasant summer evening, then came home and ate. After our supper, Kritikano said she wanted to sleep with me. She wanted to have physical sex with me, she said. This was so sudden. I didn't know what to do, which is exactly what I said to her. This is so sudden. I don't know what to do. Looking directly at me, Kritikano said,
Whether or not you go with me to Crete, Mr. Okada, I want you to take me one time, just one time as a prostitute. I want you to buy my flesh. Here, tonight. It will be my last time. I will cease to be a prostitute, whether of the flesh or of the mind. I will abandon the name of Kritikano as well. In order to do that, however, I want to have a clearly visible point of demarcation, something that says, it ends here.
I understand you're wanting a point of demarcation, but why do you have to sleep with me?
Don't you see, Mr. Okada, by sleeping with the real you, by joining my body with yours in reality, I want to pass through you, this person called Mr. Okada. By doing that, I want to be liberated from this feeling of defilement inside me. That will be the point of demarcation.
Well, I'm sorry, but I don't buy people's flesh. Kritikano bit her lip.
How about this, then? Instead of money, give me some of your wife's clothing and shoes. We'll make that the price of my flesh. That should be all right, don't you think? Then I will be saved.
Saved? By which you mean that you will be liberated from the defilement that Noboru Wataya left inside you?
Yes, that is just what I mean,
said Kritikano. I stared at her. Without false eyelashes, Kritikano's face had a much more childish look. Tell me, I said, who is this Noboru Wataya guy, really? He's my wife's brother, but I hardly know him. What is he thinking? What does he want? All I know for sure is that he and I hate each other.
Noboru Wataya is a person who belongs to a world that is the exact opposite of yours, said Kritikano.
Then she seemed to be searching for the words she needed to continue.
In a world where you are losing everything, Mr. Okada, Noboru Wataya is gaining everything. In a world where you are rejected, he is accepted, and the opposite is just as true, which is why he hates you so intensely.
I don't get it. Why would he even notice that I'm alive? He's famous, he's powerful. Compared to him, I'm an absolute zero. Why does he have to take the time and trouble to hate me? Kritikano shook her head.
Hatred is like a long, dark shadow. In most cases, not even the person it falls upon knows where it comes from. It is like a two-edged sword. When you cut the other person, you cut yourself. The more violently you hack at the other person, the more violently you hack at yourself. It can often be fatal. but it is not easy to dispose of. Please be careful, Mr. Okada. It is very dangerous. Once it has taken root in your heart, hatred is the most difficult thing in the world to eradicate.
And you were able to feel it, weren't you? The root of the hatred that was in Noboru Wataya's heart.
Yes, I was. I am,
said Kritikano.
That is the thing that split my flesh in two. That defiled me, Mr. Okada. Which is why I do not want him to be my last customer as a prostitute. Do you understand?
That night, I went to bed with Kritikano. I took off what she was wearing of Kumiko's and joined my body with hers, quietly and gently. It felt like an extension of my dream, as if I were recreating in reality the very acts I had performed with Kritikano in my dream. Her body was real and alive, but there was something missing, the clear sense that this was actually happening. Several times the illusion overtook me that I was doing this with Kumiko, not Kritikano. I was sure I would wake up the moment I came, but I did not wake up. I came inside her. It was reality, true reality. But each time I recognized that fact, reality felt a little less real. Reality was coming undone and moving away from reality, one small step at a time. But still, it was reality.
Mr. Okada,
said Kritikano with her arms wrapped around my back.
Let's go to Crete together. This is not the place for us anymore. Not for you, and not for me. We have to go to Crete. If you stay here, something bad is going to happen to you. I know it. I am sure of it.
Something bad?
Something very, very bad,
Kritikano prophesied, in a small but penetrating voice, like the prophet bird that lived in the forest. 15. The only bad thing that ever happened in Mei Kasahara's house. Mei Kasahara on the Gushi source of heat.
Hello, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
said the woman's voice. Pressing the receiver to my ear, I looked at my watch. 4 o'clock in the afternoon. When the phone rang, I'd been asleep on the sofa, drenched in sweat. It had been a short, unpleasant nap, and now there remained with me the physical sensation of someone having been sitting on top of me the whole time I was asleep. Whoever it was had waited until I was asleep, come to sit on top of me, and got up and gone away just before I woke.
Hello,
cooed the woman's voice in a near whisper. The sound seemed to have to pass through some extra thin air to reach me.
This is Mei Kasahara calling.
Hey, I tried to say, but my mouth still wasn't moving the way I wanted it to. The word may have come out like some kind of groan.
What are you doing now?
She asked, in an insinuating tone.
Nothing, I said, moving the mouthpiece away to clear my throat. Nothing. Napping.
Did I wake you?
Sure you did. But that's okay. It was just a nap.
Mei Kasahara seemed to hesitate a moment. Then she said,
How about it, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? Will you come over to my house?
I closed my eyes. In the darkness, hovered lights of different colors and shapes.
I don't mind, I said.
I'm sunbathing in the yard, so just let yourself in the back.
Okay.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, are you mad at me?
I'm not sure, I said. Anyhow, I'm going to take a shower and change, and then I'll come over. I've got something I want to talk to you about.
I took a quick, cold shower to clear my head, turned on the hot water to wash, and finished off cold again. This did manage to wake me up, but my body still felt dull and heavy. My legs would begin trembling, and at several points during the shower I had to grab the towel bar or sit on the edge of the tub. Maybe I was more fatigued than I had thought. After I stepped out of the shower and wiped myself down, I brushed my teeth and looked at myself in the mirror. The dark blue mark was still there on my right cheek, neither darker nor lighter than before. My eyeballs had a network of tiny red lines, and there were dark circles under my eyes. My cheeks looked sunken, and my hair was in need of a trim. I looked like a fresh corpse that had just come back to life and dug its way out of the grave. I put on a t-shirt and shorts, a hat and dark glasses. Out in the alley I found that the hot day was far from over. Everything alive above ground, everything visible, was gasping in the hope of a sudden shower, but there was no hint of a cloud in the sky. A blanket of hot, stagnant air enveloped the alley. The place was deserted, as always. Good. On a hot day like this, and with my face looking so awful, I didn't want to meet anyone. In the yard of the empty house, the bird sculpture was glaring at the sky, as usual, its beak held aloft. It looked far more grimy than when I had last seen it, more worn down. And there was something more strained in its gaze. It seemed to be staring hard at something extraordinarily depressing that was floating in the sky. If only it could have done so, the bird would have liked to avert its gaze, but with its eyes locked in place the way they were, it had no choice except to look. The tall weeds surrounding the sculpture remained motionless, like a chorus in a Greek tragedy, waiting with bated breath for an oracle to be handed down. The TV aerial on the roof apathetically thrust its silver feelers into the suffocating heat. Under the harsh summer light, everything was dried out and exhausted. After I had surveyed the yard of the vacant house, I walked into May Kasahara's yard. The oak tree cast a cool-looking shadow over the lawn, but May Kasahara had obviously avoided that, to stretch out in the harsh sunlight. She lay on her back in a deck chair, wearing a tiny chocolate-colored bikini, its little cloth patches held in place by bits of string. I couldn't help wondering if a person could actually swim in a thing like that. She wore the same sunglasses she had on when we first met, and large beads of sweat dotted her face. Under her deck chair were a white beach towel, a container of suntan cream, and a few magazines. Two empty Sprite cans lay nearby, one serving as an ashtray. A plastic hose with a sprinkler lay out on the lawn, where no one had bothered to reel it in after it was last used. When I drew near, May Kasahara sat up and reached out to turn off her radio. She had a far deeper tan than last time. This was no ordinary tan from a weekend at the beach. Every bit of her body, from head to toe, had been beautifully roasted. Sunning was all she did all day, it seemed, including the whole time I was in the well, no doubt. I took a moment to glance at the yard. It looked pretty much as it had before, the broad lawn well manicured, the pond still unfilled and looking parched enough to make you thirsty. I sat on the deck chair next to hers and took a lemon drop from my pocket. The heat had caused the paper wrapper to stick to the sweet. May Kasahara looked at me for some time without saying anything.
"What happened to you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? What's that mark on your face? It is a mark, isn't it?"
"I think it is. Probably. But I don't know how it happened. I looked, and there it was."
May Kasahara raised herself on one elbow and stared at my face. She brushed away the drops of sweat beside her nose and gave her sunglasses a little push up to where they belonged. The dark lenses all but hid her eyes.
"You have no idea at all? No clue where it happened or how?"
"None at all."
"None?"
"I got out of the well, and a little while later I looked in the mirror, and there it was. Really, that's all."
"Does it hurt?"
"It doesn't hurt. It doesn't itch. It is a little warm, though."
"Have you been to the doctor?"
I shook my head. "It'd probably be a waste of time."
"Probably,"
said May Kasahara.
"I hate doctors, too."
I took off my hat and sunglasses and used my handkerchief to wipe the sweat from my forehead. The armpits of my gray T-shirt were already black with sweat.
"Great bikini," I said.
"Thanks."
"Looks like they put it together from scraps, making the maximum use of our limited natural resources."
"I take off the top when nobody's around."
"Well, well," I said.
Not that there's all that much underneath to uncover,
she said, as if by way of excuse. True, the breasts inside her bikini top were still small and undeveloped.
Have you ever swum in that thing? I asked.
Never. I don't know how to swim. How about you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?
Yep, I can swim.
How far?
Far?
10 kilometers?
Probably. Nobody home now?
They left yesterday, for our summer house in Itsu. They all went to go swimming for the weekend. All is my parents and my little brother.
Not you?
She gave a tiny shrug. Then she took some Hope regulars and matches from the folds of her beach towel and lit up.
You look terrible, Mr. Wind-Up Bird.
Of course I look terrible. After days at the bottom of a well with almost nothing to eat or drink, who wouldn't look terrible?
Mei Kasahara took off her sunglasses and turned to face me. She still had that deep cut next to her eye.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, are you mad at me?
I'm not sure. I've got tons of things I have to think about before I start getting mad at you.
Has your wife come back?
I shook my head. She sent me a letter. Says she's never coming back.
Poor Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
said Mei Kasahara. She sat up and reached out to place her hand lightly on my knee.
Poor, poor Mr. Wind-Up Bird. You know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, you may not believe this, but I was planning to save you from the well at the very end. I just wanted to frighten you a little, torment you a little. I wanted to see if I could make you scream. I wanted to see how much it would take until you were so mixed up you lost your world.
I didn't know how to reply to this, so I just nodded.
Did you think I was serious when I said I was going to let you die down there?
Instead of answering right away, I rolled the lemon drop wrapper into a ball. Then I said, I really wasn't sure. You sounded serious, but you sounded like you were just trying to scare me too. When you're down in a well, talking to somebody at the top, something weird happens to the sound. You can't really catch the expression in the other person's voice. But finally, it's not a question of which is right. I mean, reality is made up of these different layers. So maybe in that reality, you were serious about trying to kill me, but in this reality, you weren't. It depends on which reality you take and which reality I take. I pushed my rolled-up sweet wrapper into the hole of a Sprite can.
Say, could you do me a favor, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?
Said Mei Kasahara, pointing to the hose on the lawn.
Would you spray me with that? It's so hot, my brain's gonna fry if I don't wet myself down.
I left my deck chair and walked over to pick up the blue plastic hose on the lawn. It was warm and limp. I reached behind the bushes and turned on the tap. At first, only hot water that had been warmed inside the hose came out. But it cooled down until it was spraying cold water. Mei Kasahara stretched out on the lawn, and I aimed a good, strong spray at her. She closed her eyes and let the water wash over her body.
Oh, that feels so good! You should do it too, Mr. Wind-Up Bird!
This isn't a bathing suit, I said, but Mei Kasahara looked as if she was enjoying the water a lot and the heat was just too intense for me to resist.
I took off my sweat-soaked T-shirt, bent forward, and let the cold water run over my head. While I was at it, I took a swallow of the water. It was cold and delicious.
Hey, is this well water? I asked.
Sure is. It comes up through a pump. Feels great, doesn't it? It's so cold. You can drink it, too. We had a guy from the health department do a water quality inspection, and he said there's nothing wrong with it. You almost never get water this clean in Tokyo. He was amazed, but still, we're a little afraid to drink it. With all these houses packed together like this, you never know what's going to get into it.
But don't you think it's weird? The Miyawaki's well is bone dry, but yours has all this nice, fresh water? They're just across the alley. Why should they be so different?
Mei Kasahara cocked her head.
Maybe something caused the underground water flow to change just a little bit, so their well dried up and ours didn't. Of course, I don't know what the exact reason would be.
Has anything bad happened in your house? I asked. Mei Kasahara wrinkled up her face and shook her head.
The only bad thing that's happened in this house in the last 10 years is that it's so damn boring.
Mei Kasahara wiped herself down and asked if I wanted a beer. I said I did. She brought 2 cold cans of Heineken from the house. She drank one and I drank the other.
So, tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, what's your plan from now on?
I haven't really decided, I said, but I'll probably get out of here. I might even get out of Japan.
Get out of Japan? Where would you go?
To Crete.
Crete? Does this have something to do with that Creta what's-her-name woman?
Something, yeah. Mei Kasahara thought this over for a moment.
And was it Creta what's-her-name that saved you from the well?
Creta Kano, I said. Yeah, she's the one.
You've got a lot of friends, haven't you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?
Not really. If anything, I'm famous for having so few friends.
Still, I wonder how Creta Kano found out you were down in the well. You didn't tell anybody you were going down there, right? So how did she figure out where you were?
I don't know, I said.
But anyhow, you're going to Crete?
I haven't really decided I'm going to go. It's just one possibility. I have to settle things with Kumiko first. Mei Kasahara put a cigarette in her mouth and lit up. Then she touched the cut next to her eye with the tip of her little finger.
You know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, just about the whole time you were down in the well, I was out here sunbathing. I was watching the garden of the vacant house and baking myself and thinking about you in the well, that you were starving and moving closer to death little by little. I was the only one who knew you were down there and couldn't get out. And when I thought about that, I had this incredibly clear sense of what you were feeling. The pain and anxiety and fear. Do you see what I mean? By doing that, I was able to get so close to you. I really wasn't going to let you die. This is true, really. But I wanted to keep going, right down to the wire, right down to where you would start to fall apart and be scared out of your mind and you couldn't take it anymore. I really felt that that would be the best thing for me and for you.
Well, I'll tell you what, I said. I think that if you really had gone down to the wire, you might have wanted to go all the way. It might have been a lot easier than you think. If you went that far, all it would have taken was one last push, and then afterwards you would have told yourself that it was the best thing. For me and for you. I took a swig of beer. Mei Kasahara thought about that for a time, biting her lip.
You may be right,
she said.
Not even I know for sure.
I took my last swallow of beer and stood up. I put on my sunglasses and slipped into my sweat-soaked T-shirt.
Thanks for the beer.
You know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
said Mei Kasahara,
last night, after my family left for the summer house, I went down into the well. I stayed there 5 or maybe 6 hours altogether, just sitting still.
So you're the one who took the rope ladder away?
Yeah,
said Mei Kasahara with a little frown.
I'm the one.
I turned my eyes to the broad lawn. The moisture-laden earth was giving off a vapor that looked like heat haze. Mei Kasahara pushed the butt of her cigarette into an empty Sprite can.
I didn't feel anything special for the first few hours. Of course, it bothered me a little bit to be in such total darkness, but I wasn't terrified or scared or anything. I'm not one of those ordinary girls that scream their heads off over every little thing. But I knew it wasn't just dark. You were down there for days, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. You know there's nothing down there to be afraid of. But after a few hours, I knew less and less who I was. Sitting still down there in the darkness, I could tell that something inside me, inside my body, was getting bigger and bigger. It felt like this thing inside me was growing, like the roots of a tree in a pot, and when it got big enough, it would break me apart. That would be the end of me, like the pot splitting into a million pieces. Whatever this thing was, it stayed put inside me when I was under the sun. But it sucked up some kind of special kind of nourishment in the darkness and started growing so fast. It was scary. I tried to hold it down, but I couldn't, and that's when I really got scared. It was the scaredest I've ever been in my life. This thing inside me, this gooshy white thing like a lump of fat, was taking me over, eating me up. This gooshy thing was really small at first, Mr. Wind-Up Bird.
Mei Kasahara stopped talking for a little while and stared at her hand.